Part 2. Reva. Chapter 9. Belgarion of Reva had not actually been prepared to occupy a throne. He had grown up on a farm in Sindaria, and his childhood had been that of an ordinary farm boy. When he had first come to the basalt throne in the Hall of the Raven King, he had known much more about farm kitchens and stables than he had about throne rooms and council chambers. Statecraft had been a mystery to him, and he had known no more of diplomacy than he had of algebra. Fortunately, the Isle of the Winds was not a difficult kingdom to rule. The Riven people were orderly, sober, and had a strong regard for duty and civic responsibility. This had made things much easier for their tall, sandy-haired monarch during the trying early years of his reign, while he was learning the difficult art of ruling well. He had made mistakes, naturally, but the consequences of those early slips and miscalculations were never dire, and his subjects were pleased to note that this earnest, sincere young man who had come so startlingly to the throne never made the same mistake twice. Once he had settled in and had become accustomed to his job, it was probably safe to say that Belgarion, or Garion, as he preferred to be called, almost never encountered major problems in his capacity as King of Reva. He had other titles, however. Some were purely honorary, others not so much so. Godslayer, for example, involved certain duties which were not likely to come up very often. Lord of the Western Sea caused him almost no concern whatsoever, since he had concluded quite early that the waves and tides needed little supervision, and that fish, for the most part, were entirely capable of managing their own government. Most of Garion's headaches stemmed directly from the grand-sounding title, Overlord of the West. He had assumed at first, since the war with the Angorax was over, that this title, like the others, was merely something in the nature of a formality, something impressive, but largely empty, which had been tacked on to all of the rest, sort of to round them out. It earned him, after all, no tax revenues, it had no special crown or throne, and there was no administrative staff to deal with the day-to-day problems. But to his chagrin, he soon discovered that one of the peculiarities of human nature was the tendency to want to take problems to the person in charge. Had there not been an overlord of the West, he was quite sure that his fellow monarchs would have found ways to deal with all of those perplexing difficulties by themselves. But as long as he occupied this exalted position, they all seemed to take an almost childlike delight in bringing him the most difficult, the most agonizing, and the most utterly insoluble problems, and then happily sitting back with the trusting smiles on their faces while he struggled and floundered with them. As a case in point, there was the situation which arose in Arindia during the summer of Garion's 23rd year. The year had gone fairly well up until that point. The misunderstanding which had marred his relationship with Tenedra had been smoothed over, and Garion and his complicated little wife were living together in what might best be described as domestic felicity. The campaign of Emperor Kal-Zakath of Meloria, whose presence in this continent had been a great cause for concern, had bogged down in the mountains of western Ktholmyrgos and showed some promise of grinding on for decades far from the borders of any of the kingdoms of the West. General Varana, the Duke of Anadil, functioning as regent for the ailing Emperor Ranbarun the 23rd, had clamped down quite firmly on the excesses of the great families of Tolnedra in their unseemly scramble for the imperial throne. All in all, Garion had been looking forward to a period of peace and tranquility, until that warm early summer day when the letter arrived from King Coradulin of Arindia. Garion and Tenedra had been spending a quiet afternoon together in the comfortable royal apartment, talking idly of little, unimportant things, more for the pleasure of each other's company than out of any real concern for the subjects at hand. Geryon lounged in a large blue velvet armchair by the window, and Senedra sat before a gilt-edged mirror, brushing her long, copper-colored hair. Geryon was very fond of Senedra's hair. Its color was exciting. It smelled good. And there was one delightfully vagrant curl that always seemed to want to tumble appealingly down the side of her smooth white neck. When the servant brought the letter from the King of Arendia, tastefully carried on a silver tray, Geryon took his eyes off of his lovely wife, almost regretfully. He broke the ornately stamped wax seal and opened the crackling parchment.
"Who is it from, Geryon?"
Tenedra asked, still pulling the brush through her hair and regarding her reflection in the mirror with a kind of dreamy contentment.
"Cora Doolan," he replied, and then began to read. "To His Majesty, King Belgarion of Riva, Overlord of the West, greetings. It is our fervent hope that this finds thee and thy queen in good health and tranquil spirits. Gladly would I permit my pen the leisure to dwell fulsomely upon the regard and affection of my queen, and I bear thee and her majesty. But a crisis has arisen here in Arendia, and because it doth derive directly from the actions of certain friends of thine, I have resolved to seek thy aid in meeting it. To our great sorrow, our dear friend the Baron of Voebor succumbed at last to those grievous wounds which he received upon the battlefield of Tul Mordu. His passing this spring hath grieved us more than I can tell thee. He was a good and faithful knight. His heir, since he and the Baroness Nerina were childless, is a distant nephew, one Sir Embrig, a somewhat rash knight more interested, I fear, in the title and lands of his inheritance than in the fact that he doth intrude himself upon the tragic Baroness. With airs most unbecoming to one of gentle birth, he journeyed straightway to Voebor to take possession of his new estates, and with him he brought divers other knights of his acquaintance, his cronies and drinking companions. When they reached Voebor, Sir Embrig and his cohorts gave themselves over to unseemly carouse, and when they were all deep in their cups, one of these rude knights expressed admiration for the person of the but recently widowed Nerina. Without pausing to think or to consider the lady's bereavement, Sir Embrig promptly promised her hand to his drunken companion. Now in Arendia, by reason of certain of our laws, Sir Embrig hath indeed this right, though no true knight would so incivilly insist upon imposing his will upon a kinswoman in her time of grief. The news of this outrage was carried at once to Sir Mandorallan, the mighty Baron of Vomandor, and that great knight went immediately to horse. What transpired upon his arrival at Voebor thou canst well imagine. Given Sir Mandorallan's prowess and the depth of his regard for the Baroness Nerina, Sir Embrig and his cohorts rashly attempted to stand in his path, and there were, as I understand, some fatalities and a great number of grievous injuries as a result. Thy friend removed the Baroness to his own keep at Vomandor, where he holds her in protective custody. Sir Embrig, who regrettably perhaps will recover from his wounds, has declared that a state of war does exist between Ebor and Mandor, and he has summoned to his cause diverse noblemen. Other noblemen flock to the banner of Sir Mandorallan, and southwestern Arendia does stand on the brink of general war. I have been informed that Leldoran of Wildentor, ever a rash youth, has raised an army of Asturian bowmen, and at this moment doth march southward with them, intending to aid his old comrade in arms. Thus it doth stand. Now that I am reluctant to bring the power of the Arendish crown to bear in this matter, since should I be compelled to make judgment, I would be forced by our laws to decide in favor of Sir Embrig. I appeal to thee, King Belgarion, to come to Arendia and to use thy influence with thy former companions and dear friends to bring them back from the precipice upon which they now stand. Only thy intercession, I fear, can avert this impending disaster. In hope and friendship, Cora Doolan. Geryon stared helplessly at the letter. "Why me?" he demanded without even thinking.
"What does it say, dear?"
Zinedra asked, laying aside her brush and picking up an ivory comb.
"Well, he says that," Geryon broke off. "Mandarallan and Leldoran."
He got up and began to swear.
"Oh, here," he said, thrusting the letter at her. "Read it."
He began to pace up and down with his fists clenched behind his back, still muttering curse words. Zinedra read the letter for herself as he continued pacing.
"Oh, dear,"
she said finally in dismay.
"Oh, dear."
"Well, that sums it up pretty well, I'd say,"
he started swearing again.
"Geryon, please don't use that kind of language. It makes you sound like a pirate. What are you going to do about this?"
"I haven't got the faintest idea."
"Well, you're going to have to do something."
"Oh, why me?"
he burst out again.
"Why do they always bring these things to me?"
"Because they all know that you can take care of these little problems better than anybody else."
"Oh, thanks," he said dryly.
"Be nice,"
she told him. Then she pursed her lips thoughtfully, tapping her cheek with the ivory comb.
"You need your crown, of course. And I think the blue and silver doublet would be nice."
"What are you talking about?"
"You are going to have to go to Arintia to get this all straightened out. And I think you should look your very best. Erends are so conscious of appearances. Why don't you go see about a ship? I'll pack a few things for you."
She looked out the window at the golden afternoon sunlight.
"Do you think it might be too warm for you to wear your ermine?"
"I won't be wearing ermine, Zinedra. I'll be wearing armor and my sword."
"Oh, don't be so dramatic, Geryon. All you have to do is go there and tell them to stop."
"Maybe. But I have to get their attention first. This is Mandarallan we're talking about, and Leldoran. We're not dealing with sensible people, remember?"
A little frown creased her forehead.
"Oh, that is true,"
she admitted. But then she gave him an encouraging little smile.
"I'm sure you can fix it, though. I have every confidence in you."
"You're as bad as all of the rest," he said a bit sullenly.
"But you can, Geryon. Everybody says so."
"I guess I'd better go talk to Brand," he said glumly. "There are some things that need to be attended to. This is likely to take me a few weeks."
"Oh, I'll take care of that for you, dear,"
she said reassuringly, reaching up and patting his cheek.
"You just run along now. I can manage things here very well while you're gone."
He stared at her with a sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach. When he arrived at Vomandor on a cloudy morning several days later, the situation had deteriorated even further. The forces of Sir Imbreg were in the field, encamped not 3 leagues from Mandorallan's castle, and Mandarallan and Leldoran had marched from the city to meet them. Geryon thundered up to the gates of his friend's stout fortress on the war horse he had borrowed from an accommodating baron upon his arrival in Arindia. He wore the full suit of steel armor that had been a gift from King Coradulan, and Iron Grip's enormous sword rode in its scabbard across his back. The gates swung wide for him, and he entered the courtyard, swung awkwardly down from his saddle, and demanded to be taken immediately to the Baroness Nerina. He found her pale-faced and dressed all in black, standing somberly on the battlements, searching the cloudy sky to the east for the telltale columns of smoke which would announce that the battle had begun.
"It doth lie upon me, King Belgarion,"
she declared almost morbidly.
"Strife and discord and anguish hath derived from me since the day I first wed my dear departed lord."
"Oh, there's no need to blame yourself," Geryon told her. "Mandarallan can usually get himself into trouble without help from anyone. When did he and Leldoran leave?"
"Oh, somewhat past noon yesterday,"
she replied.
"Methinks the battle will be joined ere long."
She looked mournfully down at the flagstones of a courtyard lying far below and sighed.
"I guess I'd better go then." Maybe if I can get there before they start, I can head this thing off.
I have just had a most excellent thought, Your Majesty.
There was a bright little smile lighting up her pale face.
I can make that task much easier.
Well, I hope somebody can. The way things look right now, I'm going to be in for a very bad morning.
Make haste, then, Your Majesty, to the field, where rude war even now dost hover above our dear friends, and advise them that the cause of their impending battle has departed from this sad world.
I'm not sure I follow that.
It is most simple, Your Majesty. Since I am the cause of all this strife, it dost lie upon me to end it.
He looked at her suspiciously.
Just what are we talking about here, Narina? How do you propose to bring all of those idiots to their senses?
Her smile became actually radiant.
I have but to hurl myself from this lofty battlement, my lord, and join my husband in the silence of the grave to end this dreadful bloodshed before it has begun. Go quickly, my lord, descend to that courtyard far below and take to horse. I will descend by this shorter, happier route and await thee upon those rude stones below. Then mayest thou carry the news of my death to the battlefield. Once I am dead, no man's blood need be spilt over me.
She put one hand on the rough stone of the parapet.
Oh, stop that, he said in disgust, and get away from there.
Oh, nay, Your Majesty,
she said firmly.
This is the best of all possible answers. At one stroke I can avert this impending battle and rid myself of this burdensome life.
Narina, I'm not going to let you jump. That's all there is to that.
Surely thou wouldst not be so rude as to lay hands upon my person to prevent me,
she said in a shocked tone of voice.
I won't have to, he said.
He looked at her pale, uncomprehending face and realized that she did not have the faintest idea of what he was talking about.
On second thought, maybe it's not such a bad idea after all. The trip down to that courtyard is likely to take you about a day and a half, so it should give you time to think this all the way through. Besides, it might just possibly keep you out of mischief while I'm gone.
Her eyes went suddenly wide as what he was saying to her seeped ever so slowly into her mind.
Thou wouldst not use sorcery to foil my most excellent solution?
Try me.
She looked at him helplessly, tears coming to her eyes.
This is most unchivalrous of thee, my lord,
she accused him.
I was raised on a farm in Sindaria, my lady. I didn't have the advantages of a noble upbringing, so I have these little lapses from time to time. I'm sure you'll forgive me for not letting you kill yourself. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go stop that nonsense out there.
He turned and clanked toward the stairs.
Oh, he said, looking over his shoulder at her. Don't get any ideas about jumping as soon as my back's turned either. I have a long arm, Narina. A very long arm.
She stared at him, her lip trembling.
That's better, he said, and went on down the stairs.
The servants in Mandoralan's castle took one look at Geryon's stormy face as he strode into the courtyard below, and prudently melted out of his path. Laboriously, he hauled himself into the saddle of the huge roan war horse upon which he had arrived, adjusted the great sword of the Riven King in its scabbard across his back, and looked around.
"Somebody bring me a lance," he commanded. They brought him several, stumbling over each other in their haste to comply. He selected one and then set off at a thundering gallop.
The citizens of the town of Omandor, which lay just beyond the walls of Mandoralan's keep, were as prudent as the servants within the walls had been. A wide path was opened along the cobblestone streets as the angry king of Riva passed through, and the town gates stood wide open for him. Geryon knew that he was going to have to get their attention, and errands on the verge of battle are notoriously difficult to reach. He would need to startle them with something. As he thundered through the green Orendish countryside, past neat thatch-roofed villages and groves of beech and maple, he cast an appraising eye toward the gray, scudding clouds overhead, and the first faint hints of a plan began to form in his mind. When he arrived, he found the two armies drawn up on opposite sides of a broad, open meadow. As was the age-old Orendish custom, a number of personal challenges had been issued, and those matters were in the process of being settled, as a sort of prelude to the grand general melee which would follow. Several armored knights from either side were tilting in the center of the field as the two armies looked on approvingly. Enthusiastically, the brainless, steel-clad young nobles crashed into each other, littering the turf with splinters from the shattered remains of their lances. Geryon took in the situation at a single glance, scarcely pausing before riding directly into the middle of the fray. It must be admitted that he cheated just a little during the encounter. The lance he carried looked the same as those with which the Mimbrate knights were attempting to kill or maim each other. About the only real difference lay in the fact that his lance, unlike theirs, would not break no matter what it encountered, and was, moreover, enveloped in a kind of nimbus of sheer force. Geryon had no real desire to run the sharp steel tip of that lance through anyone. He merely wanted them off of their horses. On his first course through the center of the startled milling knights, he hurled three of them from their saddles in rapid succession. Then he wheeled his charger and unhorsed two more so quickly that the vast clatter they made as they fell merged into a single sound. It needed a bit more, however, something suitably spectacular to penetrate the solid bone Erend's used for heads. Almost negligently, Geryon discarded his invincible lance, reached back over his shoulder, and drew the mighty sword of the Riven King. The Orb of Aldur blazed forth its dazzling blue light, and the sword itself immediately burst into flame. As always, despite its vast size, the sword in his hand had no apparent weight, and he wielded it with blinding speed. He drove directly at one startled knight, chopping the amazed man's lance into foot-long chunks as he worked his way up the weapon's shaft. When only the butt remained, Geryon smashed the knight from his saddle with the flat of the burning sword. He wheeled then, chopped an upraised mace neatly in two, and rode the bearer of the mace into the ground, horse and all. Stunned by the ferocity of his attack, the wide-eyed Mimbrate knights drew back. It was not merely his overwhelming prowess in battle, however, that made them retreat. From between clenched teeth, the King of Reva was swearing so furiously, and his choice of oaths made strong men go pale. He looked around, his eyes ablaze, then gathered in his will. He raised his flaming sword and pointed it at the roiling sky overhead. "Now!" he barked in a voice like the cracking of a whip. The clouds shuddered, almost seeming to flinch, as the full force of Belgarion's will smote them. A sizzling bolt of lightning as thick as the trunk of a mighty tree crashed to the earth with a deafening thunderclap that shook the ground for miles in every direction. A great smoking hole appeared in the turf where the bolt had struck. Again and again Geryon called down the lightning. The noise of thunder ripped and rolled through the air, and the reek of burning sod and singed earth hung like a cloud over the suddenly terrified armies. Then a great howling gale struck. At the same time, the clouds ripped open to inundate the opposing forces in a deluge so intense that many knights were actually hurled from their saddles by the impact. Even as the gale shrieked and the driving downpour struck them, flickering bolts of lightning continued to stagger across the field, which separated them, sizzling dreadfully and filling the air with steam and smoke. To cross that field was unthinkable. Grimly, Geryon set his terrified charger in the very midst of that awful display, with the lightning dancing around him. He let it rain on the two armies for several minutes, until he was certain that he had their full attention. Then, with a negligent flick of his flaming sword, he turned off the downpour. "I have had enough of this stupidity," he announced in a voice as loud as the thunder had been. "Lay down your weapons at once." They stared at him, and then distrustfully at each other. "At once!" Garion roared, emphasizing his command with yet another lightning bolt and a shattering thunderclap. The clatter of suddenly discarded weapons was enormous. "I want to see Sir Embreg and Sir Mandorallan right here," Garion said then, pointing with his sword at a spot directly in front of his horse. "Immediately." Slowly, almost like reluctant schoolboys, the two steel-clad knights warily approached him. "Just what exactly do the two of you think you're doing?" Garion demanded of them.
"Mine honor compelled me, Your Majesty," Sir Embreg declared in a faltering voice.
He was a stout, florid-faced man of about 40, with the purple-veined nose of one who drinks heavily.
"So Mandorallan hath abducted my kinswoman."
"Thy concern for the lady extended only to thy authority over her person," Mandorallan retorted hotly. "Thou hast usurped her lands and chattels with churlish disregard for her feelings and—"
"All right," Garion snapped. "That's enough. Your personal squabble has brought half of Orendia to the brink of war. Is that what you wanted? Are you such a pair of children that you're willing to destroy your homeland just to get your own way?"
"But—" Mandorallan tried to say.
"But nothing." Garion then proceeded, at some length, to tell them exactly what he thought of them. His tone was scornful, and his choice of language wide-ranging. The two frequently went pale as he spoke. Then he saw Leldoran drawing cautiously near to listen. "And you," Garion turned his attention to the young Asturian, "what are you doing down here in Mimbre?"
"Me? Well, Mandorallan is my friend, Garion."
"Did he ask for your help?"
"Well,
I didn't think so. You just took it on yourself." He then included Leldoran in his commentary, gesturing often with the burning sword in his right hand. The three watched that sword with a certain wide-eyed anxiety as he waved it in their faces. "Very well, then," Garion said after he had cleared the air. "This is what we are going to do." He looked belligerently at Sir Embreg. "Do you want to fight me?" he challenged, thrusting out his jaw pugnaciously. Sir Embreg's face went a pasty white and his eyes started from his head.
"Me? Your Majesty?" he gasped at him. "Thou wouldst have me take the field against the Ghostslayer?"
He began to tremble violently.
"I didn't think so," Garion grunted.
"Since that's the case, you will immediately relinquish all claim of authority over the Baroness Nerina to me."
"Well, most gladly, Your Majesty."
Embreg's words tumbled over themselves as they came out.
"Mandorallan," Garion said, "do you want to fight me?"
"Thou art my friend, Garion," Mandorallan protested. "I would die before I raised my hand against thee."
"Good. Then you will turn all territorial claims on behalf of the Baroness over to me at once. I am her protector now."
"I agree to this," Mandorallan replied gravely.
"Sir Embreg," Garion said then, "I bestow upon you the entirety of the barony of Voebor, including those lands which would normally go to Nerina. Will you accept them?"
"I will, Your Majesty."
"Sir Mandorallan, I offer you the hand in marriage of my ward, Nerina of Voebor. Will you accept her?"
"With all my heart, my lord," Mandorallan choked, with tears coming to his eyes.
"Ah, oh, splendid," Leldoran said admiringly.
"Oh, shut up, Leldoran." "That's it then, gentlemen,"
Your war is over. Pack up your armies and go home. And if this breaks out again, I'll come back. The next time I have to come down here, I'm going to be very angry. Do we all understand each other?
Mutely, they nodded. That ended the war. The Baroness Nerina, however, raised certain strenuous objections when she was informed of Geryon's decisions upon the return of Mandorallan's army to Vomandor.
Am I some common serf girl to be bestowed upon any man who pleases my lord?
She demanded with a fine air of high drama. Are you questioning my authority as your guardian? Geryon asked her directly.
Nay, my lord. So Embrig has consented to this. Thou art my guardian now. I must do as thou commandest me.
Do you love Mandorallan? She looked quickly at the great knight and then blushed. Answer me.
I do, my lord,
she confessed in a small voice. Well, what's the problem, then? You have loved him for years, but when I order you to marry him, you object?
My lord, she replied, there are certain proprieties to be observed. A lady may not be so churlishly disposed of.
And with that she turned her back and stormed away. Mandorallan groaned, and a sob escaped him. Oh, what is it now? Geryon demanded.
My Norina, and I will never be wed, I fear, Mandorallan declared brokenly.
Nonsense. Leldoran, do you understand what this is all about?
Leldoran frowned.
Oh, I think so, Geryon. There are a whole series of rather delicate negotiations and formalities that you are leaping over here. There is the question of the dowry, the formal written consent of the guardian. That's you, of course. And probably most important, there has to be a formal proposal with witnesses.
She is refusing over technicalities?
Oh, but Geryon, technicalities are very important to a woman.
Geryon sighed with resignation. This was going to take longer than he had thought. Come with me, he told them. Nerina had locked her door and refused to answer Geryon's polite knock. Finally, he looked at the stout oak planks barring his way. Burst, he said, and the door blew inward, showering the startled lady seated on the bed with splinters. Now, Geryon said, stepping over the wreckage, let's get down to business. How big a dowry do we think would be appropriate? Mandorallan was willing, more than willing, to accept some mere token, but Nerina stubbornly insisted upon something significant. Wincing slightly, Geryon made an offer acceptable to the lady. He then called for pen and ink and scribbled with Leldoran's aid a suitable document of consent. Very well, he said then to Mandorallan. Ask her.
Such proposals doth not customarily come with such unseemly haste, your majesty,
Nerina protested.
It is considered proper for the couple to have some time to acquaint themselves with each other.
You are already acquainted, Nerina, he reminded her. Get on with it. Mandorallan sank to his knees before his lady, his armor clinking on the floor.
Wilt thou have me as thine husband, Nerina?
He implored her. She stared at him helplessly.
I have not, my lord, had time to frame a suitable reply.
Try yes, Nerina.
Is such thy command, my lord?
If you want to put it that way.
I must obey, then. I will have thee, Sir Mandorallan. Oh, with all my heart.
Splendid, Geryon said briskly, rubbing his hands together. Get up, Mandorallan, and let's go down to your chapel. We'll find a priest and get all of this formalized by supper time.
Surely thou art not proposing such haste, my lord,
Nerina gasped. As a matter of fact, I am. I have to get back to Riva, and I'm not going to leave here until the two of you are safely married. Things have a way of going wrong in Arendia if somebody isn't around to watch them.
I am not suitably attired, Your Majesty,
Narina protested, looking down at her black dress.
Oh, thou wouldst not have me married in a gown of sable, Hugh.
And thy, Mandarallan also objected. I am still under arms. A man should not approach his wedding clad in steel.
I don't have the slightest concern about what either of you's wearing, Geryon informed them. It's what's in your hearts that's important, not what's on your backs.
But,
Narina faltered.
I do not even have a veil.
Geryon gave her a long, steady look. Then he cast a quick look around the room, picked up a lace doily from a nearby table, and set it neatly atop the lady's head.
Charming, he murmured. Can anyone think of anything else?
A ring?
Lelderin suggested hesitantly. Geryon turned to stare at him.
You too, he said.
Oh, but they really ought to have a ring, Geryon,
Lelderin said defensively. Geryon considered that for a moment, concentrated, and then forged a plain gold ring out of insubstantial air.
Will this do?
He asked, holding it out to them.
Might I not be attended?
Narina asked in a small, trembling voice.
It is unseemly for a noble woman to be wed without the presence of some lady of suitable rank to support and encourage her.
Go fetch somebody, Geryon said to Lelderin.
Ah, but whom should I select?
Lelderin asked helplessly.
I don't care. Just bring a lady of noble birth to the chapel, even if you have to drag her in by the hair.
Lelderin scurried out.
Is there anything else?
Geryon asked Mandarallan and Narina in the slightly dangerous tone that indicated that his patience was wearing very thin.
It is customary for a bridegroom to be accompanied by a close friend, Geryon,
Mandarallan reminded him.
Lelderin will be there, Geryon said, and so will I. We won't let you fall down or faint or run away.
Might I not have a few small flowers?
Narina asked. Geryon looked at her.
Certainly, he replied in a deceptively mild tone. Hold out your hand.
He then began to create lilies, rapidly, popping them out of empty air and depositing them one after another in the startled lady's hand.
Are they the right color, Narina? I can change them if you like, purple perhaps, or chartreuse. Maybe bright blue would suit you.
And then he finally decided that he was not really getting anywhere. They were going to continue to raise objections for as long as they possibly could. They were both so accustomed to living in the very heart of their colossal tragedy that they were unwilling, unable even, to give up their mournful entertainment. The solution of necessity was going to be entirely up to him. Knowing that it was a trifle overdramatic, but considering the mental capacities of the two involved, he drew his sword.
We are all now going directly to the chapel, he announced, and the two of you are going to get married.
He pointed at the splintered door with a sword.
Now march, he commanded.
And so it was that one of the great tragic love stories of all time came at last to a happy ending. Mandarallan and his Narina were married that very afternoon, with Geryon quite literally standing over them with flaming sword to ensure that no last-minute hitches could interrupt. On the whole, Geryon was rather pleased with himself and with the way he had handled things. His mood was self-congratulatory as he departed the following morning to return to Riva.